so we're about all ready to start. We're about on time. So thanks very much for coming back on time. To introduce our interviewee here, I'll just give you a little story. Today is the exact anniversary of 22nd of September 2016. It was a Thursday last year rather than a Friday. And Jean and I, my wife, were preparing to set off by train to come down to Berkhamsted to run last year's festival. We were up early, it's a long way from West Yorkshire. We had the radio on at breakfast time, and at about 7:45, BBC Radio 4, what else, thought for the day. With the Reverend Giles Fraser. And the Reverend Giles Fraser gave his thoughts for the day. I can't honestly remember what it was.
Nor can I.
I have to admit. But in passing, he made two or three references to the power and the glory and the whiskey priest. And there was I about to deliver the 2016 festival here. And a little light bulb went on in my head, and I could tell it went on in Jean's head as well, thinking, gosh, power and the glory. Priesthood, all that stuff, the whiskey priest. I wonder whether Giles Fraser for next year, so even before last year.
I hope you've got your drink sorted out then.
We had a reminder. So I emailed him and said, how about you're being interviewed in Berkhamsted, not as a green expert, not necessarily even as a green fan, I don't know, we'll hear in a moment, but simply to talk about the priesthood, speaking to a priest about priesthood. Perhaps with the idea of putting some of my questions on the hook of some of the priests in Green's novel, starting from there and then seeing where that leads us. So that's where we are, and I'm delighted to say that Giles Fraser said yes, and here he is. So just very quickly to introduce him, I know we've got a very international audience here, and I really don't know how far his fame has taken him beyond these shores. But he certainly first came to my notice, and most people, I think, in the UK, in 2011, are we talking about? 2011, when you were Dean of St Paul's?
Canon Chancellor
at St Paul's, and there was an Occupy movement outside St Paul's, out on the steps there in that little triangular area in front of the cathedral. Giles got caught up in that and eventually resigned his position there. And there was quite a hoo-ha in the press and in the media and so on. He's since moved on to be parish priest in South London in Newington. And he also is well known in this country, of course, now for quite a lot of media work, for work for The Guardian. He appears on the radio in The Moral Maze, which I know is a favourite of quite a number of our audience. I spotted him last week in the Daily Politics on BBC Two one day, I noticed. And he pops up on Question Time on a Thursday evening from time to time, etc. So that's our interviewee today, the Reverend Giles Fraser.
Thank you.
Welcome to Berkhamsted.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
So just to pick up on that, well, you're not being advertised, Giles, as a green aficionado. Are you in any... Could you be described as a green fan?
Definitely a green fan. Not an aficionado. There'll be lots of things that I haven't read. And some things that I've read a long time ago. The Power and the Glory is just the most astonishingly good book. Monsignor Chiotte, Third Man. So the film, you know. There's bits and bobs. But I also... I have a little passing interest in Green himself, because he does seem to me such an engaging character. I feel fascinated by him, and I don't know as much about him as probably anybody else here, so it's a bit odd that I'm sitting up top. But nonetheless, I do find him a very engaging character, and I feel a sort of empathy towards him.
Right, okay.
No.
Now, just before we get on to Green's priests, I just want to fill in a little bit more of the biography I gave a moment ago, particularly for people from overseas. That whole business of St Paul's, your position at St Paul's, what happened outside St Paul's and your resignation, has some relevance to our more general talk about the nature of the priesthood and how you see the priesthood. Can you just give us a potted summary of what actually happened, how you saw it, why you resigned?
Sure. Well, it was, I mean, it's quite straightforward, really. So the Occupy movement, which people may remember, was a movement that began in protest, I suppose, in response to the first big grassroots protests about austerity and the banks having collapsed and all that sort of thing. And it was a sort of grassroots protest about that. It arrived, it started in America, and then a version of it arrived, and it was going to protest outside the London Stock Exchange. And it so happens that the land on which the Stock Exchange is owned is private land. So they... Surprise, surprise, yeah. And so they were... The police immediately kicked them off that, and they camped in front of the cathedral. And, I mean, ever since the Middle Ages, the front of the cathedral and the side of the cathedral, St Paul's Cross, has been a place for public contestation, a place for debate and public debate. And this seemed to be an important public debate of whatever you thought of it. It was a public debate of national significance. And right at the beginning, before it got, you know, before lots of homeless people joined it and it became something different, it was that. Now, there were some of my colleagues who were very against their presence. They were scruffy and mucky and so forth, and wanted to evict them, to get the police in to evict them. My own view was that the church should not be... I'd seen some evictions that had happened before. There was an eviction I saw on YouTube. This is actually what really swung it for me. I saw the police in Portland evict Occupy Portland, and it was bloody violent. I mean, they went in and they were really sort of, you know, they went in extremely hard. And I thought, does the church really want to be sanctioning us going in and evicting these people and having the police going with batons and things like that on the front of St Paul's Cathedral? So I said I was just completely against eviction and we were going to have to find another way to sort it out. But we were... The cathedral is run by a group of us, and we went for a vote, and I was in the minority after the vote, and so I had to resign because I wasn't going to lend my name to... that sort of eviction. So, I mean, it was pretty straightforward. It was a matter of principle. And though life was quite tough afterwards, because I had no idea what I was going to do afterwards, I have not, for a moment, thought it was the wrong thing to do.
Right. And you've moved on to Newington. This is a really gormless question. What does a parish priest do in a place like Newington? What's your job actually amount to?
Yeah, I mean, so it's Elephant and Castle is for people who don't know what that is. The whole idea of what a parish priest does is actually, in a place like Newington, is actually quite a complicated question because traditionally, in England particularly, the idea of the parish priest is very much linked to community. So they're embedded in their community. And when I was a parish priest in a place that had a very strong sense of community, I was parish priest of Putney before, it's very obvious what you do. You just basically, you have a ministry of loitering around in the thick parts of community where people gather. In the Elephant and Castle, it's one of the places of greatest social churn in London. There's almost no such thing as community in a place like that. And then it's very difficult to know what the church does in a place where community has broken down. Thousands of people, tens of thousands of people come through and go my parish all the time. That Northern Line runs underneath my vicarage, I can hear it. So I'm literally travelled through. And people, immigrant communities come and go and come and go and come and go. So it's a very moot question. And actually it pushes you back onto perhaps a sort of deeper idea of priesthood, which is I'm not a priest as a community worker that you would do if you're, you know, in the schools and at the various different village halls and things like that, because there isn't any of that. I'm actually a much more of a sort of priestly priest vicar, which is I say the Mass, I pray for my people. It's much more religious rather than social worky, if you understand what I mean. More about scholarly, more about, you know, writing and things like that. So the idea that we could talk about the history of this if you wanted to, but the idea that, you know, the priest is a sort of general good egg in the community and goes around being nice to people and visiting people, that sort of breaks down in a place like that. So it raises a question about what a priest does there. And actually the priest ends up becoming much more of a religious functionary in terms of writing, in terms of celebrating the Mass, and that sort of thing. I quite like that as well. I'm generally not very good at pastoral care. I'm too grumpy with people. So this is maybe why I quite like green. and the idea that, you know, that sort of old idea that, that the parish priest is always sort of professionally nice. I'm just not good at being professionally nice. It just doesn't work with my character. So I think I'm probably in the right place.
Okay. Now, I'm going to quote in a few minutes some of Green's priests and kind of raise issues on the back of that. But, of course, you're an Anglican priest.
Yes.
And Green's priests are Catholic
Yes.
priests. Can you give us, again, a potted summary of what the differences are that might make a difference, given that we're going to be talking about Catholic priests? Or in the first instance, we're going to be talking about Catholic.
Well, not as much as you might think. I mean, let's not give you a potted history of the Reformation, because let's not do that. We're bore for Britain. But basically, I'm a Catholic priest who doesn't like to be told what to do by a bloke in Rome. Okay, so that's basically what I am. I'm basically a Catholic priest who has a problem with Roman authority. So I, and those who are high church, Anglican Catholic priests like me, I always describe Roman Catholics as Roman. Okay, we're all Catholics. Okay, this is slightly sort of like, can you what?
We're not Romans as Roman Catholics, we're just Catholics.
Who are?
Yes,
I understand that. I know that. No, I understand that. But I'm explaining why. I know why other people disagree with you, but why would disagree with me. But why I call them Romans, because I think we're all Catholics. I claim Catholic too, you see. So I'm a Catholic as well. And by our creeds, we say part of the one holy Catholic and apostolic church. So we would claim as Anglicans to be Catholics. So the way in which I would distinguish between Anglican Catholics and Roman Catholics is I would call Anglican Catholics Anglicans and Roman Catholics Romans. That's how I would distinguish. That's just my rule of, and that's a familiar rule of thumb to call them that way amongst Anglican clergy, Anglicans generally. That's not intended to be any disparagement of Romans. It's just that it's a way of claiming Catholicism more broadly than the Roman Catholic Church. So, okay. So I would say. That there was less difference than you might think. There's less difference in terms of, I mean, if you came to my church and you went to a Roman Catholic church, you'd be hard pressed, you know, if you weren't au fait with the finer details of the liturgy, to see any difference. It would look pretty much the same, my church would. And theologically, apart from the question of authority, which, as I say, is like, you know, we're bolshy and we don't like to be told what to do. Broadly speaking, there is quite a strong overlap on. And I think I would share quite a lot of Green's theology. I think Green is, he's a remarkably Protestant. He feels like a remarkably Protestant Roman Catholic. By which I mean, I think he's an Augustinian. But that's what I mean. I mean, Martin Luther was an Augustinian friar, and the things that are important to Luther feel like they animate Green as well. And by which I mean that it feels to me when I read his work that what is uppermost is the question of salvation. It's like, you know, we're all desperately, you know, we're all buggered, we're all broken. There's that very strong sense of original sin, that very, very strong sense of human brokenness, and that very strong sense of our need for redemption. even amongst the clergy, which is why I like it very much. So the clergy also stand in need of redemption. They're also broken. They also stand in need of redemption. Now, that's just a very Augustinian story. It's a story that has a sort of, a strongly Protestant feel sometimes. But with Green, you get it, but within the context of Roman Catholic theology.
Right. That's interesting.
I say that without again, as I say, without the knowledge that would back it up. But there is I know that he is. I imagine he is sort of. He's Roman Catholic in terms of his sort of tribal alliances, strongly Roman Catholic. But that's not. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the pure theology of it.
Sure.
And that sense, it's very much about human brokenness in the way that the sort of Reformation was.
Okay, that's interesting. Let me try one or two of Green's priests on you then, because I think this does come from what you're saying. I've started with Monsignor Quixote. I'll read a bit from Monsignor Quixote and ask you to comment. And this is to do with how a priest goes about his work, but the challenges a priest has in doing the job he does. And this is Quixote speaking of moral theology specifically. Quixote says this: "Ah, I always found that a very difficult subject, moral theology. I very nearly failed to pass, even in Madrid, during his training. Moral theology doesn't play a great part in parish work. When the banker comes to me, or the garagist, it's not very often. Their problems are usually very simple ones. Well, I trust to my instinct." So there's a double sort of thing you might want to open up there. One is, how hard is it to train as a priest? Are there intellectual demands that some priests might actually find quite difficult? But then secondly, the idea that when doing the job, you might actually say, well, that was my training, but I don't look at these books of moral theology anymore. I trust my instincts.
That's not what I get out of that passage.
Okay.
I think I get out of that passage a much more radical thing to say, which I think is very interesting, which is moral theology is not that important. And actually, for a certain sort of Christianity, the Christianity we're talking about here, morality is less important. Now, that might sound shocking. If you look at Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, one of the very first, which is a sort of great work of Protestant salvation narrative, one of the temptations, one of the very early temptations that the pilgrim has where he might settle down is in a village called Morality. And it's next to one called Civility. Okay. And that's the idea that all you have to do is keep the rules and be good and keep the rules. And if you keep the rules, basically keep the moral rules, all is well. You don't need to be a priest for that. Okay. The priest bit comes, it's not about, we're not moral policemen. The priest bit comes if it's really all about human brokenness and salvation, about acknowledging your brokenness and acknowledging your need for God. Blessed are those who know their need of God. Funnily enough, some of the people who are most far away from this sort of religion are people who think they're good, who even in fact are good. Self-righteousness is an incredibly dangerous thing, because the self-righteous, the good priest, would not go through would not have the same sense of dependence upon God, upon that which is outside of his or her control, as the whiskey priest. The whiskey priest knows that he is a broken person, and through that brokenness has a wisdom that is a priestly wisdom that is not available to the morally righteous. So don't think the Pharisees were bad people. They were good people. And that was part of the problem. They were so good they didn't realise how broken and how much in need we are. That's part of the story here. So that's precisely why Green strikes a chord with me, both as a human being, and because he's not a good person. You know, and he's not a conventionally good person, and he writes about not conventionally good characters. And, you know, and that's me. And I suggest that's most of us. And the idea that as broken people, we are there still offered the opportunity of being fixed, of salvation. But it doesn't come through conventional morality.
Yeah.
So I think when Kyoti says, you know, all of that whole idea of the priest as a sort of moral, you know, morally upright, I think it's been a temptation that we go through. And of course, it's obviously, you know, when the person of the Berkhamsted Echo sitting at the back will write down, you know, vicar says morality rubbish, shocker. You know, so it's terribly easy to get, you know, to get caricature, you know, to get attacked for that. But it's sort of, I mean, I spend my life, especially now, I spend my life with the broken, the angry, the semi-criminal, the, you know, the drinkers. That this is what I spend my life with. And the idea that you go in there and, you know, your job is to enforce some sort of morality, it's crazy. It's not what we do. So I'm a bit like Monsignor Kyoti, really. And also I'm a hypocrite if I did that, because I'm a broken priest myself.
Okay. Well, that moves on nicely to the next priest I wanted to look at. I noticed you brought a copy of the Power and the Glory, yeah. The Whiskey Priest. Green said that the whiskey priest, the purpose of the story, the overall scheme of the story, is to make a clear distinction between the man and the office. The man is, in your terms, a broken man. He's an alcoholic. He's fathered an illegitimate child. But still, he has his priestly function, which he carries out at great risk to himself, and of course, at the end, he dies for it.
Heroically, yeah.
Yeah, is that distinction between the man and the office, between the broken person and the person who is in a position of authority by virtue of his vocation, is that something that resonates with
yes,
you?
Yes, it is, absolutely right. I mean, I probably wouldn't use the word office, I'd probably use the word calling. Okay.
Yep.
So the gap between what I, you know, I don't care about what titles or, you know, what that sort of thing, that's what makes me think by office. But by calling, you know, there is always a gap between who we are and who we feel called to be. I mean, I've always preferred, I probably have to explain this a bit, but I've always preferred hypocrites to cynics. Much prefer hypocrites to cynics. A cynic goes, we're all bad people and it doesn't matter, and we're just like, there's no gap between who they are and their aspiration. Hypocrites like me, much better people, I think, is that I say, look, I'm bad, this is what I want to be, and there's a massive gap between what I am and what I want to be, and that's just where it is. And I live an aspirational life that is often tripping itself up, okay? And yes, I'm definitely a hypocrite. But to sit here and go, oh, there's no gap between what I want to be, because, like, nobody's ever going to achieve anything. They're the dangerous people. The cynics are the dangerous people, okay? Please give me an honest hypocrite every day than a shrug-your-shoulders cynic that there's nothing to change about themselves. So I think that gap between who you are and who you want to be. Look, of course, I mean, you know, those who want to point out that all clergy are hypocrites, of course we're hypocrites. I mean, no one can live up to that calling. No one can live up to the calling. So, I mean, and I think Jesus makes a point of dramatising the impossibility of so much of our calling. You know, he makes Christianity out to be, you know, there's a bit after the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5 where he just constantly talks about, you know, even if you look at a woman, you know, thinking, oh, she's nice, you've committed adultery. Even if you just think bad thoughts about your brother, you can't escape it. He's actually trying to make it almost impossible. I want you to face the impossibility of quote unquote being good. The impossibility of being good. Now, once you've realised that knowledge, then happy are those who know their need of God. That's where the need of God comes from, the brokenness. And what I love about the whiskey priest is that sense of need for God's raw, absolutely raw in this person. Okay. Even through, you know, you always get the feeling that through periods of doubt or anxiety or periodic, you know, I don't believe in anything and so forth, you can not believe in anything but still have a raw sense of your need for it. And it's the need for it that is the stuff that shines out of well, especially the power and the glory.
You talk about doubt there. There's an interesting point that occurred to me. It doesn't apply to the whiskey priest, but I ask you it anyway.
Yeah.
What happens to the priest who loses his faith? He actually ends up thinking, do you know what? I don't think there is a God. I'm not convinced anymore. What does a priest like that do? Does that happen?
Yes, it's quite happened to me. And it happens a bit. It happened to me for a while in a very specific context. I hadn't been ordained that long, and my first job that was my own job was as a parish priest in the Black Country, in outside Wolverhampton, in Walsall. It was the outer city council estate in Walsall, and it was a whites only council estate, head of the National Front in the area, really poor, really rough. I'm just trying to give you a flavour of the place. You know, it was a place where there were burnt out cars, and people used to sit on their sofas in the front of their houses, and it was a violent, rough place. And it was a very Anglo-Catholic, old style Oxford movement, big Anglo-Catholic church. And it was in the middle of a roundabout, and there were flats all the way up the roundabout, and people used to shoot each other in the flats over the top of the house. And you'd be lying in bed at night, and you'd be hearing people shooting over the top of the flats. It was extraordinary. So I had a funeral of a baby, a child, came in, and I remember the funeral really, really well. They had a little white coffin, and there were three people at the funeral. Now, normally for the funeral of a child, there's like a lot of people come. I mean, it's a big thing, you know. And there were three people. There was mum, her best friend, and another friend. And there was like no men. I was the only bloke there. And I was just, and it was freezing cold that day. It was February, I think. It was awful, absolutely awful. And I just thought to myself, this is rubbish. This is, you know, all my time I'd been at Oxford, I'd done lots of academic-y stuff and so forth. And it was just like, I can't see any way through this. You know, it was too bleak. So I thought, this is all rubbish. But like, you know, you can see why you think that after going through such a horrible funeral. But that was on the Friday, whatever it was. And Sunday, my job is to be the priest. I'm the priest. So I stand behind the altar. It is indeed right. It is our duty and our joy at all times, in all places. And I'm doing the Eucharist. I'm doing the Eucharistic prayer. But inside I'm going, the light's gone out. I don't get it. I mean, I can still do the thing. Now, of course, the traditional teaching of the priest in those situations is that actually it's not your internal belief system that makes it work. It's your ordination ontologically makes it possible for you to preside. I was also incredibly strong sense that when we stood and said the creed and the congregation goes, we believe in God the Father, they were all believing for me. It was almost like I was saying, and this is why I have maybe a green light doctrine of the church, I'm not just a sort of a Reformation type of person, is that actually we are the believing body. And I'm a part of this. And sometimes I'm asking you to carry me. You know, sometimes you need to carry the priest. Because if I'm doing funerals of babies and things like that, I hope you understand there are times when it just doesn't... I've gone, you know. So I will need you lot to be supporting me in my believing. And so I have a very strong sense that the subject of believing is the people of God, the congregation, not just the individual priest. Cut off from the church, it's a terrible business. But in the church, I've gone through periods of doubt, but because I'm in the church, the church is the body that supports me. So I feel hugely grateful for the believing support that I have, you know, I've been, you know, that I've been supported by.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, Back to Power and the Glory, but I thought we might just give a bit of context now. We've been talking about the individual priest, what he believes in, his doubts, that kind of thing. But the other context, of course, in Power and the Glory is that Green is talking about a very specific historic situation in Mexico. He'd gone and done this research about this godless state that was persecuting its priests and so on. And the whole context of the book is persecution of priests. It's an attempt to extirpate society of its priests. Is that just a kind of piece of history now, or is that still going on to the Christian church around the world anyway?
It's worse now than it was then. I mean, communism, you know, was a part of the persecution of the church then, and of course it's not very successful. Imagine these places that they're talked about are really quite religious now, as is the Soviet Union, and you know, all of many of the places from which they tried to purge religion. But of course, Christianity. But I mean, you know, Christianity is now in danger in the Middle East, and the persecution of the church in the Middle East is one of the great tragedies of our age.
What form does that persecution take?
Well, I mean, you know, if you. I was in Iraq a couple of years ago, in the northern part of Iraq, and if you go there, this used to be one of the great cradles of Christian civilization. In Syria and, you know, northern parts of Iraq. And, you know, we have a sense of the Western church as being the church. I think Green has a very strong sense of the Western church being the church. But actually the Church of the East was just as much a part, if not more a part of the church than the Church of the West. And the Church of the East, the church that, you know, said the Lord's Prayer in Aramaic, still to this day says the Lord's Prayer in the same language that our Lord said it, things like that. That church has been destroyed successively by, at the moment by ISIS and by, you know, that sort of persecution. But all through the Middle East, you know, this probably Egypt is the most Christian now part of the Middle East, but Copts there are being, you know, terribly persecuted, Christianity persecuted in Lebanon, and we can have a debate about whether it's persecuted in Israel, then through Syria and Iraq. You know, this was a core part of the Christian world, and in most of our lifetimes, it's collapsed. So, to be honest, that's a much more substantial form of persecution, I mean, world historically, I think, than the communist persecution of the church, which was not very successful.
Yeah. Back to an individual priest. Now, I've got another reading here, just to run past you, from this time the honorary consul, and now we've got a chap in there, Leon Rivas.
And you have to explain this because I don't know the honorary consul.
I will. He's Leon Rivas has become a kind of social and political revolutionary. He's a priest,
okay.
But he's given up the priesthood, not because of theological doubts or anything like that, but for the following reasons. This is what he says. He's asked by one of the characters, "What's wrong with the Gospels?" And this former priest says, "They make no sense. Anyway, not in Paraguay. Sell all and give to the poor. I had to read that out to them while the old archbishop we had in those days was eating a fine fish from Iguanzu and drinking a French wine with the general. Of course, the people were not actually starving. Starvation makes a man desperate. Malnutrition makes him too tired to raise a fist. The words used to stick on my lips, suffer little children. And there the children sat in the front rows with their pot bellies and their navels sticking out like doorknobs. And then I distributed the host and I drank the wine. Wine. Which of these poor souls had ever tasted wine?" Now, my question is, or the area I want to open up is, the idea that I think Reva seems to have that the priesthood is something, the church is something to do with some notion of social justice, that he can't be saying one thing and realising that it had no meaning for the real lives of the poor people he was ministering to.
Well, I mean, I think he's right. And I have some sympathy with the sort of, I don't know whether it's a liberation theology thing that's you know, that's going on there. Of course, I think part of the problem is the poverty of the church's teaching about the Eucharist. To think there's a gap between the two. Because, of course, the Eucharist is a stylized Passover meal, which is, you know, what Jesus was in Jerusalem to celebrate at the Last Supper, which you're... And the Passover meal is a great celebration of, you know, freedom from slavery. So what you're really celebrating at the Mass is celebrating calling for is a freedom from oppression, from slavery, from, you know, from Egypt to the Promised Land, from Ramesses II to, you know, so this isn't just a sort of like, you know, medieval mumbo jumbo about, you know, bread and bodies and, you know, what's, you know, people who think of it like that. What is we're doing here? What is the Mass? The Mass is, do this in remembrance of me. Is this meal is a Passover meal, and you're remembering the great story of human freedom, of salvation, of corporate salvation. Salvation for the people of Israel, which you're rehearsing. So, I think people need to feel again the idea that that side of the church, what you're rehearsing in the Mass, is a great cry of human freedom. So the idea that it gets cut off from that is a terrible heresy for me. It's a terrible heresy. It just becomes a little bit of magic. Or a little bit of theatre, you know. It's not magical theatre. That's not what's going on here. This is the great cry of human freedom. And for me, that's what. So he's right. I mean, it can't. Now, he also is saying about the bishop or whoever it is that he's a hypocrite. And I've already made my views known about hypocrisy. Is that I quite like a glass of red as well. So I'm not gonna. There is a self-righteousness about the activist that I have a certain suspicion about, but nonetheless, there is something in that call that resonates with me. Yeah, definitely.
Does the Christian Church actually do enough in the whole area of social justice?
No, of course not. We're never going to do enough.
What should it be doing? What could it be doing? Is that too?
Well, okay. So let's just. I mean, the Church does much more than people give it credit for. The church, and by the church I mean all the churches really, are very much sources of good in our land and in our communities. I think I really think they are, and I don't think they often get enough credit for the quiet and gentle way in which they work. My personal view is the Anglican Church, and I know this is not a view in which I'm, and I think this view I sort of. I got more after I left St. Paul's. I think the establishment of the Church of England turns us into courtiers, basically makes us more interested in dressing up and being around the House of Lords and you know, all that sort of, that relationship with the powers that be. And I think it blunts our prophetic witness. So I wish that the Church was able to stand back from the establishment, stand back from, you know, the coronations and all of this sort of stuff, and actually was more about what it did on the ground. I think that the glory of the Church of England is the parishes. I think it works well in its parish system. I think it works badly when it comes to bishops and our leadership.
Interesting. Now, I'm aware that what Giles is saying will have sparked all sorts of questions in you, and I do want to leave some time. I have a tendency to talk the hour out, and I want to avoid that. But if you just allow me, before I take some questions, to ask one more thing, which is to quote a line from a priest in Graham Greene before we open it up to questions. And it's a very famous line. You may know it yourself, Giles. It's a priest right at the end of Brighton Rock, in this case, who says, he's talking after the death of Pinky, this teenage gangster who's had a suicide pact with Rose, which has gone wrong. Pinky's ended up dead, this awful character. And Rose is there. Rose is pregnant, she thinks. If I've got the plot right, and she's seeking consolation from a priest about what she should now think about Pinky, the father of the child to be. And the father says, the priest says, "You can't conceive my child, nor can I or anyone, the appalling strangeness of the mercy of God."
Yes.
To offer some consolation. She certainly takes that as consolation.
Yes.
Any comment on it? The appalling strangeness
of
the mercy of God.
Completely beautiful and right. An utterly staggering thing to say. Yeah, my theology is... That's why I love Graham Greene. I didn't know that quote, so thank you for... I mean, so just to return...
But putting it very crudely, if that means that a hoodlum like Pinky Brown is going to go to heaven...
Yeah. Forgiveness is a really terrible thing, okay? This is where I return back to my theme about morality. Okay, you misunderstand Christianity if you see it through the lens of morality. It has moral consequences, but if you see it through the lens of morality, you'll get it wrong, okay? Forgiveness is generally not fair, okay? Forgiveness is the heart of the Christian gospel, and forgiveness is generally not fair. You know, it is very, very clear in the gospel about... You know, the one that goes astray is the one that the sheep that goes astray is the sheep that Jesus is after. The lost soul is the soul that has to be brought back, and so forth. And this often means, you know, that's where you hang around. Okay, you don't hang around with the respectable. You hang around with I know some real bastards in my. That's what I spend my time with, actually. With Pinkies and the sort, you know, and I pray for their salvation. I mean, that's what it is, and that salvation doesn't come from me. This is the pure theology bit. It comes from this mysterious other about which it's very difficult to talk. You know, at best you can make what Thomas Monk called raids on the unspeakable. T.S. Eliot, you know, that you're making raids on the unspeakable to articulate it, but then they're always failing. You're always failing to articulate this grace, divine grace, that we're dependent upon grace. And the idea that the priest is as dependent upon divine grace as Pinky is an outrage, and it's true. It's outrageous. Christianity's outrageous. You know, and this is a form of its outrageousness. And I for one, am very glad of it. I'm very, very, very needful of it. And this is what I mean about Greene's profound sense of human brokenness. You know, it is the Harry Limes and the Pinkies and the people like that, the people that... And the you know, in the general in is it the general in whatever
the lieutenant
yeah. You know, and all these people he does, you know, he does these sorts of characters so well, but he also leaves open something about their, you know, their need for redemption. It's a cry, the cries of redemption, reading those things. And I feel like, can I show you the... You shared quotes in there. I just want to show you one quote. One quote that I got. It's just from The Power and the Glory. And it's just one phrase, actually. And I just have this phrase always in my head. And, you know, it'd be a great book for a great autobiography title for a priest. The priest is described as an odd sort of servant. An odd sort of servant. And I think that's definitely what priests are, an odd sort of servant. And you're a servant of this calling. It's impossible. It's incredibly hard. My God, it drives you to drink. You know, I mean, I'm not puzzled by the whiskey priest. I'm puzzled by the sober priest. That's what puzzles me. I have no idea how to make sense of the sober priest. But the whiskey priest, I completely understand the whiskey priest. You know, and in fact, if you're not a whiskey priest, I don't think you've understood. I mean, you know, partly it's just, you know, if you do spend your life, I mean, I'm obviously playing it for laughs a bit, but if you spend your life with coffins of small babies and people who are You know, I want to cry just talking about it, okay? And you can't do that day in, day out without... It's hard to do that day in, day out without exploding or drinking or going off the rails or doing something stupid. And, you know, that's part of the... That's part of the sort of tragedy of and the difficulty of being a priest.
Oh, that must be the point when I stop and give people a chance to have a say. I don't know whether we've got problems with the microphone. Lucy, you wouldn't like to be the microphone monitor, would you? Given the acoustics in this place, it is much better if we use a microphone, if at all possible. I know we had problems in the first session. But if you put your hand up, we've got one up already there, Lucy, or we've got several, so take them in whatever turn you want. Go on, you're in charge, and give someone the microphone, and here comes the question.
Thank you. Very wonderful discussion, thank you. You don't like Rome, and the Brexiteers don't like Brussels. Is there a parallel?
Oh, definitely. Oh, definitely. Completely. I mean, I'm a leaver. I'm sure my leaving instincts are very similar to my Protestant... I've written about this as well. I've written very similar to my Protestant instincts. And actually, you can map on... Roman Catholics are much more sympathetic to the European Union as a project of Christendom, as a broader coalition of... Where Protestants like me, we're Bolshevik. And we've always been Bolshevik, and we've always not liked what... I mean, the Reformation was the first Brexit. You know, the Reformation was a Brexit. The Reformation was... now, I mean, let's not get into this, because I argue about this endlessly, and people get all hot under the collar, so please let's not argue about Brexit. I try and, you know, everybody has to... But just as a matter of historical observation... the Reformation, Henry VIII and all of that, was a form of Brexit which was breaking away from the Roman Church and having authority, you know. I mean, Henry VIII could have run his campaign, if he ever needed a campaign, on bring back control. You know, if he wanted to run a campaign for the Reformation, that's probably what he would have run it on. Enough about that. But it's a good question. You're right. You're right.
One further back, Lucy.
Lucy, just leave it on. I'll turn up and down.
Thank you very much for a marvellous and very inspiring and insightful talk. I'd like to ask you if you had the opportunity, perhaps, to share a bottle of red with Graham Greene.
Oh.
Or with the spirit of Graham Greene.
Yeah.
What else might you want to share with him, or be able to?
The second bottle. I mean, one wouldn't be enough, I have to say, dear boy. That's not... Look, he was a troubled soul and we're from... I mean, he feels to me like he was a troubled soul and we were from... You know, we have... you know, we're different sorts of... I don't know, do you know, I caught the end of The Gentleman before... the presentation about the Congo. And I'm afraid I had to finish off some work, so I didn't catch completely at all. But the idea of someone coming to Greene asking for religious advice and wanting a religious conversation, I understand the irritation of people. I know this sounds a ridiculous thing for the priest. This is another thing for the Berkhamsted Echo. But I understand completely the irritation of people always wanting to talk about religion with you. It's like, oh, really? Can we talk about something else? So I don't know what else I'm going to talk about with Graham Greene, but I quite like to talk about something completely different with him. Actually, just a couple of bottles of red and talk about life, the universe and everything. It'd be great. But I don't know the answer. Maybe writing. Maybe how you write. Maybe the style and craft of writing. Maybe that's what I'd like to talk about.
Yeah. Another one there, Martin.
Great question.
Hi, Charles. Thank you for the frankness and the honesty of your comments. I'd like to ask you to pursue this idea of being broken, which, of course, is the title of Jimmy McGovern's amazing recent series. Now, salvation is everywhere in Greene. I think that's quite clear, particularly the Pan and Glory in Monsignor Quixote. Do you perceive the idea of atonement being buried somewhere in the main characters in those novels? Atonement, of course, being what Jimmy McGovern pursues at length.
I didn't see that. I've heard about it. I didn't see the... Right. I know what you're talking about, but I didn't see it.
It's worth seeing.
Do you know, there's a funny sort of... My training incumbent, when I was a curate, and he was a parish priest, very, very lovely man, in fact, and he loved Monsignor Curti. Made me read it. It's the first book he made me read as a curate, actually, which I must go back and read it again. He used to be in the SAS. He was in it before he was... he wasn't a priest in the SAS. He was in the SAS. Okay. He was a specialist in interrogation techniques, which was... can you imagine what that's like, being a curate to the... This sort of, like, 80-year-old priest who's a specialist in interrogation techniques in the SAS. Anyway... he once said to me, I've always remembered it, and I thought there was a wisdom in it, I'm not really interested in my own salvation. And that seemed to be absurd, because he was always, it seemed to me like that was his life, or certainly with other people. And it was almost like, it was something that he was desperate for, but, I mean, what that quote from the priest is, that mysterious other, which is something you can't manipulate or bully or...
Yeah.
Or make happen by stomping your foot. You know, there's no negotiating with the divine. Yeah. There's no sort of like, it just, you know, you can shout all you like, but it doesn't, you don't have that sort of a conversation. This otherness, this need for that which is other. The reason I keep on returning to happy are those who know their need of God. As I say, I don't know all of Green's work, and I'm really happy for you to... But there isn't that moment of redemption in the way that people who like a happy ending often want. There is a strong sense of human dependency. That's what I get from it. Very strong sense of human dependency. The salvation bit is left to God, and I think quite rightly so.
Yeah, there are obviously hints of how salvation could happen at the end of Brighton Rock Rose... May pray for Pinky, perhaps the child will. Perhaps there is
there
a
go.
Sense of atonement by right. the vicarious right. nature. But yeah, there are obviously broken characters throughout Graham Greene. Thank you.
Hi, that was delightful. It was marvellous. Thank you. I just wanted to mention as Green got older, he recovered a lot of his early Anglicanism. And,
is that right?
And this is sort of an interesting convergence. He was drifting to the edges of Catholicism. The last time he went to confession was, I think, the tail end of 1951, the beginning of 1952, at Fat Diem. He saw a battlefield, sent him to confession. They didn't go again for almost 30 years, though he did go to church about every 3 weeks without receiving the sacraments. And
he didn't receive the sacraments?
No, he felt that, the way he put it, he says, my faith has rules and I believe in the rules and I can't live up to them. He's not in the state
and
of
I
grace.
And I can't live up to them.
Yeah. And, yeah. About 1970 or a little later, an Irish woman wrote him a letter saying, you know, she was afraid of certain things in his books. And he wrote back, essentially, that if he had his time back, he would have been much more respectful of the Anglican Church. And the language that he used was identified by Priscilla Chadwick, who was the principal of Berkhamsted School here, as something her father had written. He was, I forget which Chadwick, I guess
yeah,
Henry.
Yeah, they were a mafia, yeah.
As being from the Archic documents. And so Green was much more generous to Catholicism at the end of his life.
Anglicanism.
Anglicanism, than he was in the middle. And many of us, I'm a Catholic, were brought up with a certain kind of diffused bigotry.
Yeah.
My mother used to say she could look into a Protestant's eyes and tell they were Protestant.
Yeah,
that kind of, that kind of diffused Irish bigotry. And it seems like Graham Greene got over some portion of that.
Yeah. It's a class thing as much as anything, actually. I mean, I suspect it's a class thing, that Anglican Roman Catholic thing has a sort of class, strong class aspect, historically. That doesn't entirely surprise me, but that's very interesting. I mean, obviously times had changed, I expect. You know, his school days were Anglican, and you know, it's hard to escape those sorts of prayers and choral evensong and all of that sort of stuff. It sort of gets inside you. I mean, I have a similar complex relationship, not the same as Green's, because I don't have any quote unquote relationship with Roman Catholicism in the way, but I do with Judaism. So my father's Jewish, my wife is Jewish and Israeli, my son is Jewish. So my surname used to be Friedeberg. So I have a complicated relationship, which is not a million miles away from the relationship you might have between Judaism and Roman Catholicism. So I have this sort of relationship with this, as it were, older parent religion, which is really emotionally complicated. In fact, I'm writing a book about it now. That's exactly what I'm working on. So I know something of that ambivalence you feel about that sort of relationship. But it's interesting how because we're such a different society, so much of the sort of the animus, well, the unpleasantness between Anglicanism and Roman Catholicism has disappeared. I mean, it really has disappeared. The only time I've ever had it, I'll tell you one time whenever it stoked it in me. It was when I was in Blakenall Heath in Wolverhampton, and I was great friends with the Roman Catholic opposite number, my Father Frank. It was a great, great man, and we used to play golf together because we always used to play golf, and I was a part of the clergy. All the Roman Catholic clergy used to play together on a Monday, and I would play with them. And after a while, I was just one of the priests in the gang. And there was a Catholic priest's golf day, where they all came from the diocese and from the area, and we all played together. And it was great, and I was invited. I was the token sort of, and I was there, and we were all together and so forth. Anyway, I came third in the day, but they disqualified me because I wasn't a proper priest. And that's the only time I've been really pissed off. I deserved, I think it was a packet of three Titleist golf balls, which I didn't get. And it's the only time I've ever gone, actually, I'm really pissed off with you, Laura.
Okay, I think we've time probably for one more. Martin.
Good afternoon, sir. I know you only from political programmes on the TV, and I've always liked your approach. And by the way, I was born and bred Danny Elephant.
Uh-huh.
I'm interested, though, we all know about persecution of the Christian church around the world, but particularly in what you just said about your family, I wonder why you include Israel in the persecution of the Christian church.
Well, so I didn't actually say that. I questioned whether that was...
I beg your pardon.
I didn't actually say that. So that there's a question about whether Israel is non-persecutory,
yes.
Generally non-persecutory,
yes.
Of its immigrant Christian community, generally, even though it's not terribly good on the Ethiopian Christians that are living. If you go to church in Tel Aviv, which I've been to quite a lot, to some of the Ethiopian Christian churches there, they're not. They feel rather picked upon by the authorities, but that's not it. I think it would just be about Palestinian Christians. It would be about Palestinian Christians. So you know, Bethlehem, Bet Jala, Bet Sahor. These were Christian villages, and when you talk to Palestinians who've left, if you talk to them and you say, why are you leaving? They will not, generally speaking, they don't say it's because of Hamas or... They often say it's because of the occupation and because of the conditions of occupation. Now, I don't think Israel deliberately targets Christians. I definitely don't think that. But... I think it's complicated being a Christian in the Holy Land. And I think it's complicated by the occupation.
And that would be for Palestinian Arabs and Palestinian Christians?
Palestinian Arab Christians. Yeah.
What?
Arab Christians, yeah. Palestinian Arab Christians. Yeah. So Palestinian Christians living in the West Bank. It is hard for them. They're squeezed all over the place. I mean, there are Christians. I mean, I've been to church in Gaza. You know, you don't get this story very much. But there are two hospitals run by the church in Gaza. There's quite a lot of Christians that live in those places, and they generally. I mean, you know, you could say that they're not really in a position to criticise Hamas, but they generally don't. But they generally do feel the presence of the Israeli army. Now, I say that. My wife is in the Israeli army. You know, so I'm not... I don't say this from any particular... I think that, you know, the Middle East is a tragedy, and Israel-Palestine is a tragedy. And it's a tragedy. And I love Israel, and I love the Palestinian people. And the idea that we've got to choose between our commitments, I think is one of the great tragedies. I mean, I think that's one of the parts of the tragedy. I think it's really possible to be committed to both peoples. I believe in a two-state solution and blah, 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 blah. But even so, the situation is so complicated and fraught and difficult and dangerous that you can't simply say that the reason that Christians have left that part of the Middle East has nothing to do with the occupation, because it does.
Okay.
Thank you.
We ought to draw a line there. Giles has a young baby boy, and he takes his due share of childcare for this child, so he has to leave us. I need to make sure that he gets away reasonably promptly. But wasn't that wonderful? If your head is not spinning now with thoughts that are going to be whirring around there, you were asleep during the last hour. That was fantastic. Thanks very much, Giles.